Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And we want you to get involved. Get involved. We kind of said this a lot yesterday. We kind of went through a lot going through getting involved, which means that we need you to support campaigns. We need you to get out there. As a matter of fact, when people start talking about politics and you just shake your head and go, you need to start listening to G.R. Mobley or Reclaiming the Republic. It's not about me. There's plenty of other groups out there that we're working with, and it's all about petitions. So why don't you start working with us, though? You can say, hey, you need to start, getting involved with what we're doing here. Because, again, it's not about me. It's about actually utilizing those tools in the Constitution that he gave us to be able to do this. I say this all the time. Only he knew where we would be and what we would be going through, how godless we would become. And regardless of how godless people are, most everybody, it is innate within a person's, in the soul of mankind. It's just innate in all human beings that they want liberty. They want to be able to choose for themselves. I don't know a communist that doesn't want to, make the choice of what they're going to have for dinner, what they're going to wear. It is the fascist that wants to tell people, you got to dress like me. It's the fascist that says, this is what you're going to eat. But a true human being is going to decide what they're going to eat. And as a matter of fact, even if you're eating what you're supposed to eat, are you eating it in the order that they tell you? Eat it this, eat it this way. If you give them the power, they will dictate every aspect of every process, everything. So this is one of the reasons why this new global communism and this new global government is going to be the nicer, the lighter, the more friendly communist state of government, because you're going to believe that you do have liberties. And there's certain things you won't be able to have. But that's okay, because you are convinced you don't need it. You don't need more information. And as we look at this concept of, amalgamating or just blending all of this to create one world religion and one world government, if that doesn't alarm you folks, see, I'm okay with that. If that is being done by him, our Savior, when he comes, we'll know it's him. There's no way we can be fooled on that. Well, I can't say that, because obviously the Bible says that there will be many people that will be fooled just because of their illiteracy, ignorance, what have you. But all of these things are screaming, you better start doing something. And so I hate using fear-mongering. What I like is actually giving you the solution. Giving you the solution gives you hope. Now, I'm hoping that you will support Jerry Winstrom. Jerry Winstrom's campaign out there costs money to get out there, to meet people, to drive, and to do what is needed to get the votes. If there's other ways you can help and say, you know what, I don't have much money, this is all I can give you, but how else can I help you? I'm on social media. Do you have messages I can start sending? That type of thing he would love. He would love any kind of help you can give him. We need to start pulling resources, and one of the most valuable resources is our time. So maybe at some points in time, if you're on social media and you're on pages in Missouri, start promoting Jerry. Anyway, get involved, folks. And I would recommend that we get involved like our liberty depends on it. And with that, I will let's put this to the side. Let's get into the Supreme. Welcome back, Sean. We were just diving into, and we ran out of time, on this comment or commentary regarding supremacy and so forth. So Any go backs by you, or because we kind of cut you off? You were an amen to everything you were saying.
No, sir.
All right. All right.
Good. Good.
All right. So let's go ahead and dive into this.
There is no doubt, sir, but under this Constitution, treaties will become the supreme law of the land. Nor is there any doubt but the Senate and President possess the power of making them. But though the treaties are to have the force of laws, they are in some important respects very different from other acts of legislation. In making laws, our own consent alone is necessary. In forming treaties, the concurrence of another power becomes necessary. Treaties, sir, are truly contracts or compacts between the different states, nations, or princes who find it convenient or necessary to enter into them. Some gentlemen are of opinion that the power of making treaties should have been placed in the legislature at large. There are, however, reasons that operate with great force on the other side. Treaties are frequently, especially in time of war, of such a nature that it would be extremely improper to publish them or even commit the secret of their negotiation to any great number of persons. For my part, I am not an advocate for secrecy in transactions relating to the public, not generally even in forming treaties, because I think that the history of the diplomatic corps will evince, even in that great department of politics, the truth of an old adage that, quote, honesty is the best policy, end quote. And this is the conduct of the most able negotiators. Yet sometimes secrecy may be necessary, and therefore it becomes an argument against committing the knowledge of these transactions to too many persons. But in their nature, treaties originate differently from laws. They are made by equal parties, and each side has a half of the bargain to make. They will be made between us and the power at the distance of 3,000 miles. A long series of negotiation will frequently precede them. And can it be the opinion of these gentlemen that the legislature should be in session during this whole time? It well deserves to be remarked that though the House of Representatives possess no active part in making treaties, yet their legislative authority will be found to have strong restraining influences upon both President and Senate. In England, if the king and his ministers find themselves during their negotiation to be embarrassed because an existing law is not repealed or a new law is not enacted, they give notice to the legislature of their situation and inform them that it will be necessary before the treaty can operate that some law be repealed or some be made. And will not the same thing take place here? Shall less prudence, less caution, less moderation take place among those who negotiate treaties for the United States than among those who negotiate them for the other nations of the earth? And let it be attended to that even in the making of treaties, the states are immediately represented and the people immediately represented. Two of the constituent parts of government must concur in making them. Neither the President nor the Senate solely can complete a treaty. There are checks upon each other and are so balanced as to produce security to the people.
Okay, so interestingly enough, it doesn't seem like there's really concern whether they can just make any kind of treaty or not. It seems they're more concerned on the idea that, hey, hold on here, they are going to be doing this in secret. I mean, he kind of points this out. And, you know, in the middle here, he says, because I think that the history of the diplomatic corps will evince, even in that great department of politics, the truth of an old adage that honesty is the best policy. And this is the conduct the most able negotiators, yet sometimes secrecy may be necessary. So I don't understand the mixture of that. Are treaties dishonest? Because why did he invoke that? We would think that the treaties are going to be honest treaties, unless there was a concern over the corruption of those. The reality that he should have said that would have probably made this shorter, which was said in Virginia, that they cannot make a treaty that is not within the delegated powers. Had he said that, that would have actually, you know, duplicated that. But he went around this long way. And I just think that, you know, there's some people, the way they see things and the way they explain them, they just don't do a good job on the technical side. And what really kills me is at the very beginning, I'm sure you caught this, where he says, treaties, sir, are truly contracts or compacts between the different states, treaties, or princes who find it convenient or necessary to enter into them.
That's exactly what I was about to say. I was looking for a place to jump in and say, I wish you, somebody would have said, talking out of both sides of your mouth, aren't you?
Well, correct. I mean, these states... Why are they having to go through the ratification process? They have to figure out whether it's worth their, you know, it's in their best interest to enter into this agreement. It's obviously an agreement that they have to ratify. How it's not a compact in this guy's head, like I said, he's an outlier. And so
yeah, he says between the different states, and we can leave out nations or princes and convenient, and find it necessary to enter into them. That was the whole impetus behind the colonies joining together as a union, correct?
Right. Yep, that, correct. Why they created the Confederation. Why they even created the Articles of Association. They felt compelled due to the harassments of Britain to create the association to say, we got to fight back a little bit. We got to organize. We got to enter into this agreement. And I think maybe he missed some of these things. I don't know. I'd have to actually look. Maybe he's just young. He might. I do know in Virginia, a gentleman by the name of, I think, Corbin, was a, you know, he was like a teenager when he went to the debates. And it was a real honor and a privilege for him to be there in the midst of these, you know, great men. I don't know if Corbin ever came to, you know, prominence politically or anything else. But it was kind of brought up that this, here's a guy that was very new at this. And as a matter of fact, the reason that came up, and this is in Pauline Myers, The Struggle to Ratify the Constitution, or I think Madison's Struggle to Ratify the Constitution. What she says, and the reason she brings up his age and his, you know, lack of wisdom and decorum, he actually insulted Patrick Henry. And everybody, when he said what he said to Patrick Henry, everybody thought Patrick Henry was just going to challenge him to a duel. Because Patrick Henry kind of had a short fuse. But instead, Patrick Henry got up and mocked him and then made this huge, you know, I don't know, this huge dramatic display of bowing to this young fool after making a fool out of him. And so everybody goes, oh, okay, so we got the best of him that way. But, you know, maybe James Wilson is kind of new, but I do know, and was it you that looked up who the justice was on the Supreme Court that got thrown into debtor prison? Do that real quick.
All right.
Google what Supreme Court justice went to debtor's prison while they were seated on the court. They were removed and had to go to debtor's prison. I want to say it was James Wilson.
I think so, yeah.
And what I'm kind of alluding to is maybe he's just young and, you know, inexperienced and just doesn't, you know, all the cylinders aren't firing yet. He's just still cutting his teeth, you know, only chewing on one side of his mouth, whatever.
He's a young bull up on top.
Yeah, possibly. And so I have to look at his age, what have you, but, you know, you don't.
Yeah, it was Wilson.
It was Wilson. Okay, so that actually states right there that, you know, he's out there because debtor's prison, I mean, they took that stuff seriously. And I would have a hard time understanding how somebody like that would be, you know, couldn't avoid debtor's prison. Sure, look at what a spendthrift Thomas Jefferson was. He was a spendthrift, big time. Spend. It's to a point.
Kind of the opposite of what we got today, huh?
No. I mean,
$500 million.
Yeah, but with Thomas Jefferson, the day he died, they foreclosed on his estate. They went in and I think what ended up happening was they didn't get everything out of the estate, but they wanted to make sure that they got their pound of flesh out of all of his debt, all the debtors. So anyway, let's go down to money now. He's going to talk a bit about money and so forth. Let's go ahead and dive into his views on this.
As to the objection that the House of Representatives may be bribed by the Senate, I confess I do not see that bribery is an objection against this system. It is rather an objection against human nature. I am afraid that bribes in every government may be offered and received, but let me ask of the gentleman who urged its objection to point out where any power is given to bribe under his Constitution. Every species of influence is guarded against as much as possible. Can the Senate procure money to effect such design? All public monies must be disposed of by law, and it is necessary that the House of Representatives originate such law. Before the money can be got out of the Treasury, it must be appropriated by law. If the legislature had the effrontery to set aside £300,000 or £400,000 for this purpose, and the people would tamely suffer it, I grant it might be done. And in Pennsylvania, the legislature might do the same. For by a law and that conformability to the Constitution, they might divide among themselves what portion of the public money they pleased. I should just remark, sir, that the objections which have repeatedly been made with regard to, quote, the number of representatives being too small, and they may possibly be made smaller, that the districts are too large and not within the reach of the people, and that the House of Representatives may be bribed by the Senate, end quote, come with an uncommon degree of impropriety from those who would refer us back to the Articles of Confederation. For under these, the representation of the state cannot exceed 7 members and may consist of only 2. And these are wholly without the reach of control or control of the people. Is there not also great danger that the majority of such a body might be more easily bribed than the majority of one not only more numerous, but checked by a division of 2 or 3 distinct and independent parts? The danger is certainly better guarded against in the proposed system than in any other yet devised.
Interesting. Okay. So I find it, you know, that he at least understands, you know, in his final position that the way this government is done, that it's just impossible. It's really hard and impossible to do it. And interestingly enough, the guy that first got in trouble for having a problem with the accountability of money was Hamilton. Point that
shocker.
Out. Yeah. Okay, so the next one is the president a tool.
I wonder if he thought about them having a sexual assault payoff / fund when he was talking about that. How did they get money out of the Treasury for that?
So we have to go through those, and we have to go through those because I want to go through those debates. We don't have the time to read through all of them, so I've got to find the time to, you know, go through and highlight, you know, what those charges were, kind of a summary of it. So anyway.
No, I'm not talking about Hamilton. I'm talking about current.
Yeah. Oh, well, so
I'm talking about the Congress has a slush fund for paying off sexual assault victims.
Okay, so all of that money comes from lobbyists now. So if you haven't seen the movie The Swamp, it was done on CRTV, where when you're sitting on a committee, the lobbyists come in and they basically say, you know, you've got to vote on this bill. Here's a bill. And one group of lobbyists or a particular lobbyist will say, if you vote yes on this bill, we will give you this much money to go into your coffers, to go into, you know, this fund that you get. Now, before you make any money off of these committees, you have to pay your debt to the party leader, because the party leader made it possible for you to be on that committee. And so, and Tom Macy actually exposes all of this on CRTV. If you go watch this, you'll actually see him talking about this whole thing. So, nonetheless, as they get this money from the lobbyist, another lobbyist will come in and go, we'll give you this much money if you vote for it. And 9 times out of 10, bad laws always are offered at a higher price, which is one of the reasons why you find everybody voting for bad laws, because they need some money. They need to figure out how to pay that debt for being on the committee during their two-year cycle. This all happens in the House. It happens on a two-year cycle. And so they've got, you know, 2 years to, you know, pay that, you know, that fee for being on this committee, because every committee you get, it adds the fee. This is the swamp. And so it's not about really what's in the bill. They're voting based on the financial rewards or the benefits 99% of the time. So that's how they get that money. That's separate from what comes out. What they use is these lobbyists use these bills to fund them. This is how Kaiser, you know, he actually pocketed all sorts of money from, you know, Obama's Green Deal or whatever that was with, I think it was solar energy.
Right.
So when you go through and you look at, you know, how do these guys, how do these mob bosses, how do these, you know, unions, how are they making money? Well, it's through these deals. They get these exclusive contracts. They're overbid and they get to pocket the money. And there's no, and they, oh, well, we'll overlook this. We won't look for that money. We'll, you know, okay. However they bake it in, this is how they transfer wealth to pay off those who really helped them get into office. This started with Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson had a lot of loyalists, which is why he grew government. He promised them jobs, and he had to get them jobs. And everybody goes, wow, look what he did. So anyway, let's do the President a tool. Go ahead.
Has a different connotation in today's colloquial language. The President a tool. If gentlemen will look into this article and read for themselves, they will find that there is no well-grounded reason to suspect the President will be the tool of the Senate. Quote, the President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into actual service of the United States. He may require the opinion in writing of the principal officers in each of the executive departments upon any subject relative to the duties of their respective offices, and he shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, end quote. Must the President, after all, be called the tool of the Senate? I do not mean to insinuate that he has more powers than he ought to have, but merely to declare that they are of such a nature as to place him above expression of contempt. There is another power of no small magnitude entrusted to this officer. Quote, he shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed, end quote.
Okay, so interestingly enough, I think the connotation might be the same, but there may be more of a, I'll just say, more of a derogatory connotation in today's use of the tool.
Absolutely.
All right. So anyway, now we're going to get to the end of the day, and we're going to go down to that the next section, Eodin Dye, 1787, in the evening. And this is basically trial by jury's jurisdiction, that type of stuff. So let's go ahead and dive into this. Thank you. Or hold it. We got about 20 seconds left. So one of the things that, you know, we're probably going to see here, I'm just going to forecast, because we're seeing that it's starting off regarding trial by jury, they're going to probably talk about, you know, the lack of real firm, this is how it's going to be done, and hopefully he'll basically say, that's because every state does it differently, and they need to comport themselves. They need to basically, they need to conform and adjust to how we do trial by juries in this state as they move forward, you know, and if they're going to form a trial period. So anyway, well, let's just see how he deals with this jurisdiction, trial by jury, and so forth. We'll be right back after this short promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let's dive into this frame of jurisdiction and what Mr. Wilson says here. Go ahead.
Just for the sake of the show, I looked up Yodam D.
Uh-huh.
It is on the same day. It's Latin.
Okay, Latin for the same day. There we go. Yeah.
Right. All right, sir.
All right.
Jurisdiction. Trial by jury forms a large field for investigation, and numerous volumes are written on the subject. But those who are well acquainted with it may employ much time in its discussion. But in a country where its excellences are so well understood, it may not be necessary to be very prolix in pointing them out. For my part, I should confine myself to a few observations in reply to the objections that have been suggested. The member from Fayette, Mr. Smiley, has labored to infer that under the Articles of Confederation, the Congress possessed no appellate jurisdiction, but this being decided against him by the words of that instrument, by which is granted to Congress the power of, quote, establishing courts for receiving and determining finally appeals in all cases of capture, he next attempts a distinction and allows the power of appealing from the decisions of the judges, but not from the verdict of a jury. But this is determined against him also by the practice of the states. For in every instance which has occurred, this power has been claimed by Congress and exercised by the courts of appeals. But what would be the consequences of allowing the doctrine for which he contends? Would it not be in the power of a jury by their verdict to involve the whole Union in a war? They may condemn the property of a neutral or otherwise infringe the law of nations. In this case, ought their verdict to be without revisal? Nothing can be inferred from this to prove that trials by jury were intended to be given up. In Massachusetts and all the eastern states, their causes are tried by juries, though they acknowledge the appellate jurisdiction of Congress.
Okay, so... Again, and he didn't really highlight it, but he did kind of point out that, you know, in the eastern states, they definitely have this sacredness towards the trial by jury. And as a matter of fact, to be clear, when we really look at how they do the impeachments and so forth, it is much aligned with, is very aligned with common law and a trial by jury. The impeachment is not going to the Chief Justice to determine, or just to the Supreme Court, where a panel of judges. The impeachment process before the president is tried for the crime, which is in the Senate, he is basically tried by a grand jury, which gives the indictment, but that is a common law jury, a grand jury. And then when you get into the court of the case itself, then it is the Senate that actually does the trial as well as the ultimate verdict. It's kind of like if you look at court today and we applied those principles in the cases, then for a person, before they could even stand a trial, they would have to be indicted of the crime. which would basically be whomever is prosecuting, doesn't matter. You've got to have, you know, everybody's got it, whatever your role is, either you're working on the prosecution, looking for the evidence, subpoenaing information, just for the indictment itself, just for that indictment, then everybody that's all involved, the prosecution, the subpoenas, all of that, guess what? They also vote at the end of the day. In a court today, the officers of the court have no say. The jury, or the trial by jury, is a jury of 12 people that have been selected that have no legal experience, but they should have an understanding of what's going on. It shouldn't be a huge learning process because it's a jury of your peers. So supposedly these people have some familiarity with the case itself or the matter of the case. Anyway, long story short, the way they created this process of accountability and, you know, removing the impeachment, all of these different things, we can start seeing how this concept of common law and a trial by jury was very sacred. They wanted to make sure that it wasn't put in the hands of one person like the king to ultimately decide your guilt. So I don't see any case other than the way our laws have been perverted by the courts to go to a point where a judge always sits in front of people and determines whether you're guilty or not. Therefore, you know, when controversies, you know, in common law actually come forward, the Seventh Amendment guarantees that you have a right to a trial by jury. And when you go to, I've got a good case in Hot Springs, Wyoming, Hot Springs County, a family, and you can read up on this, a family was in pursuit of trying to get their tax structure for their property. In other words, they were, the property was zoned for, I think, agriculture. They wanted to get it, because they weren't using it for agriculture. And because it was zoned for that, and they had this many acres, they had to pay taxes for it. And the taxes were killing them. But they needed to make money off of their property because they had a lot of property. And so they wanted to actually get it redone as commercial so that they could put a little campsite on their property because I guess they were off of Main Highway Road or what have you. But nevertheless, they went through a couple different courts and appeals and so forth, and they were denied. They were denied. They were denied. When the controversy is over $20 in a case of common law and is not, can you not look at the fact that the court has, or I should say the state, has created an assessment, a tax on you that says, hey, you have to pay taxes and this property has been classified that way and we're not going to let you change that. Well, that becomes a controversy. And if the value of that controversy is over $20, then that family had a right to actually have that trial in front of a jury. Well, they never got that. They never, and I don't know if they ever went down that path to say, because most people don't even know to ask. But what they ended up having to do is they had to go to this county legislators and say, hey, please help us. We're going to lose our property here. And they ruled in favor of the family to have it reclassified as commercial. Go read up on this, and you can start seeing how our legal system isn't what it should be, and the path of getting redress shouldn't be through the courts, my friends. It should actually be through your legislators at the county level, state level, what have you. But anyway, let's move on. Mr. Smiley speaks. Mr. Wilson then gets up and speaks, and he talks about jurisdiction and common law a little bit more on this. So let's dive into this some more.
The power of having appellate jurisdiction as to facts has been insisted upon as a proof, quote, that the convention intended to give up the trial by jury in civil cases and to introduce the civil law, end quote. I've already declared my own opinion on this point and have shown not merely that it is founded on reasoned authority, the express declaration of Congress, Journals of Congress, March 6, 1779, is to the same purpose. They insist upon this power as requisite to preserve the peace of the Union. Certainly, therefore, it ought always be possessed by the head of the Confederacy. We are told, as an additional proof, that the trial by jury was intended to be given up, quote, that appeals are unknown to the common law, that the term is a civil law term, and with it the civil law is intended to be introduced, end quote. I confess I was a good deal surprised at this observation being made, for Blackstone, in the very volume which the honorable member Mr. Smiley had in his hand and read us several extracts from, has a chapter entitled, quote, A Proceeding in the Nature of Appeals, end quote. And in that chapter says that the principal method of redress for erroneous judgment in the King's Courts of Record is by writ of error to some superior, quote, court of appeal, end quote. 3 Blackstone, 406. Now it is well known that his book is the commentary upon the common law. Here, then, is a strong refutation of the assertion, quote, that appeals are unknown to the common law, end quote. I think these were all the circumstances adduced to show the truth of the assertion that in this Constitution, the trial by jury was intended to be given up by the late convention in framing it. Has the assertion been proved? I say not. And the allegations offered, if they apply at all, apply in a contrary direction. I am glad that this objection has been stated, because it is a subject upon which the enemies of this Constitution have much insisted. We have now had an opportunity of investigating it fully, and the result is that there is no foundation for the charge, but it must proceed from ignorance or something worse.
Or something worse. Okay, so...
Ignorance or something worse.
Yeah, or something worse. Okay, so let's jump down into this little diatribe he gives on the militia. Go ahead.
It may be frequently necessary to keep upstanding armies in time of peace. The present Congress have experienced necessity, and 700 troops are just as much a standing army as 70,000. The principle which sustained them is precisely the same. They may go further and raise an army without communicating to the public the purpose for which it is raised. On a particular occasion, they did this. When the commotions existed in Massachusetts, they gave orders for enlisting an additional body of 2,000 men. I believe it is not generally known on what a perilous tenure we held our freedom and independence at that period. The names of internal insurrection were ready to burst out in every quarter. They were formed by the correspondence of state officers, to whom an allusion was made on a former day, and from one end to the other of the continent, we walked on ashes, concealing fire beneath our feet. And ought Congress to be deprived of power to prepare for the defense and safety of our country? Ought they to be restricted from arming until they divulge the motive which induced them to arm? I believe the power of raising and keeping up an army in time of peace is essential to every government. No government can secure its citizens against dangers internal and external without possessing it, and sometimes carrying it into execution. I confess it is a power in the exercise of which all wise and moderate governments will be as prudent and forbearing as possible. When we consider the situation of the United States, we must be satisfied that it will be necessary to keep up some troops for the protection of the western frontiers and to secure our interest in the internal navigation of that country. It will be not only necessary, but it will be economical on the great scale. Our enemies, finding us invulnerable, will not attack us, and we shall thus prevent the occasion for larger standing armies. I am now led to consider another charge that is brought against this system. It is said that Congress should not possess the power of calling out the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, nor the President had the command of them when called out for such purposes. I believe any gentleman who possesses military experience will inform you that men without a uniformity of arms, accoutrements, and discipline are no more than a mob in a camp, that in the field, instead of assisting, they interfere with one another. If a soldier drops his musket and his companion, unfurnished with one, takes it up, it is of no service because his cartridges do not fit it. By means of this system, a uniformity of arms and discipline will prevail throughout the United States. I really expected that, for this part of the system at least, the framers of it would have received plaudits instead of censures, as they were here discover a strong anxiety to have this body put upon an effective footing, and thereby, in a great measure, to supersede the necessity of raising or keeping up standing armies. The militia formed under this system and trained by the several states would be such a bulwark of internal strength as to prevent the attacks of foreign enemies. I have been told that, about the year 1744, an attack was intended by France upon Massachusetts Bay, but was given up on reading the militia law of the province. If a single state could deter an enemy from such attempts, what influence would the proposed arrangement have upon the different powers of Europe? In every point of view, this regulation is calculated to produce good effects. How powerful and respectful must the body of militia appear under general and uniform regulations? How disjointed, weak, and inefficient are they at present? I appeal to military experience for the truth of my observations.
Okay, so right. So here he kind of generalizes some details, not really detail-y. When we get into Virginia, I think Virginia is the one state that provides the details that really help everybody understand how important this militia system is. But nevertheless, he does make these different points, and I say today, and we've talked about it, Sean, I, and others on the show, how had we followed this militia system down into the county levels, the way it was intended, that our national system of not just security but the enforcement of laws would be done by the militia, then we wouldn't have many of these issues that we're dealing with these mercenary forces, the call to, you know, unarm ourselves, and so forth. And as a matter of fact, because so many people would be armed, and most all people would be mandated to be armed, most all people, we would be at a point where there wouldn't be any calls to say, you know, hey, you can't take the arms from that person. And I say this, Sean, when you were going through basic training, were there people that you went through that got labeled and actually kicked out of the Army because their psychological level just wasn't stable enough to be able to put grenades in their hands or to trust them with a
Absolutely.
Weapon? And so if the Army could basically say, you can't serve because we can't trust you, then I believe that that should actually just prevail. If everybody is carrying arms, and if we're actually doing the system based on the design and not just based on this voluntary force, this mercenary ideas and so forth, then, because actually if you look at it, the police system doesn't do that at all. I mean, they don't do nearly the detail of screening somebody. I remember there were one or two guys in our platoon in the Marine Corps where they put this big S on these guys' backs, big S. And so as they were going through, this means that they before we really hit the rifles, I think, and did the qualification, we did some firing and so forth. When they started doing things and they weren't supposed to do or what have you, they started, you know, marking these guys. And by the time they were putting grenades in these guys' hands, they were given a big S. And by the end of these range details and so forth, these guys were gone. Because when they walked through, everybody got walked through because you had to enter in one spot and everybody left in a different spot. And so they had to be processed through, but they didn't get a grenade in their hand. They, you know, they no longer held a rifle to fire downrange. They just sat and watched everybody else fire. Because they should never, actually, and they screen you before you even get there. We should have these processes that, you know, where it's okay that there are, you know, 1 or 2% of our society that can't bear arms. It should be okay, but the way we are configured today, we can't trust government for making those decisions. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. All right.
We had one guy who was from some rough scrabble place in New York when I was in basic, and he'd been in the street gangs and stuff like that, and the guy could do 100 push-ups in like 30 seconds. It was ridiculous. And, I mean, he could have been, you know, special forces if he really wanted to. But when he got into basic training, instead of getting into the program, he started trying to build his own hierarchy within the unit and, like, take control of the unit away from the drill instructors. Yeah.
Right.
86 him right out.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's discipline. Those types of things are big, big deals. Okay, so we're going to actually jump into Mr. McCain, because this is the last part. And, folks, when you're looking at the Pennsylvania debates, you'll notice at the very bottom there's this highlighted part called the proceedings of the amendments, or what do we call the proceedings of the meeting at Harrisburg. And this is where they kind of go through the amendments, which is September 3rd, 1788. Right, so this is almost a year later where they go back to, and they actually, this is where they hash out their amendments. But Mr. McCain offers some good insights, and actually, I really like Mr. McCain, so let's look at, because he's going to provide the anti-federalist argument. These are the arguments, because we haven't seen anybody saying what the arguments have been. They've been suppressed. So now he's going to do this. So let's start off with the arguments against the Constitution.
The arguments against the Constitution are, I think, chiefly these. First, that the elections of representatives and senators are not frequent enough to ensure responsibility to their constituents. Second, that one representative for 30,000 persons is too few. Third, the Senate have a share in the appointment of certain officers and are to be the judges on the impeachment of such officers. This is blending the executive with the legislative and judicial department. It is likely to screen the offenders impeached because of the concurrence of a majority of the Senate in their appointment. That's a good point. Fourth, that the Congress may, by law, deprive the electors of a fair choice of their representatives by fixing improper time, places, and modes of election. Fifth, that the powers of Congress are too large, particularly in laying internal taxes and excises, because they may lay excessive taxes and leave nothing for the support of the state governments in raising and supporting armies, and that the appropriation of money for that use should not be for so long as a term as 2 years. In calling forth the militia on necessary occasions, because they may call them from one end of the continent to the other and wantonly harass them. Besides, they may coerce men to act in militia, whose consciences are against bearing arms in any case. In making all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or office thereof, and in declaring that this Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme land of the law of the land. The migration or importation of such persons as any of the states shall admit shall not be prohibited prior to 1808. Nor tax or duty imposed on such importation exceeding $10 for each person. Sixth, that the whole of the executive power is not lodged in the president alone, so that there might be one responsible person, that he has the sole power of pardoning offenses against the United States, and may therefore pardon traitors for treasons committed in consequence of his own ambitious and wicked projects, or those of the Senate. That the vice president is a useless officer, and being an executive officer is to be president of the Senate, and in case of a division is to have the casting voice. Seven, the judicial power shall be vested in one Supreme Court. An objection is made that the compensation for the services of the judges shall not be diminished during their continuance in office, And this is contrasted with the compensation to the president, which is to be neither increased nor diminished during the period for which he shall have been elected. But that of the judges may be increased, and the judges may hold other offices of a lucrative nature, and their judgments be thereby warped. Mm-hmm. That in all the cases enumerated, except where the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, quote, they shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and facts, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make, end quote. From hence is inferred that the trial by jury is not secured. That they have jurisdiction between citizens of different states. 8. That there is no bill or declaration of rights in this Constitution. 9. That this is a consolidation of the several states and not a confederation. 10. It is an aristocracy and was intended to be so by the framers of it. The first objection that I heard advanced against this Constitution, I say, sir, was that, quote, the elections of representatives and senators are not frequent enough to ensure responsibility to their constituents. This is a subject that most men differ about, but there are more considerations than that of mere responsibility. By this system, the House of Representatives is composed of persons chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and the senators every 6 years by the legislatures. Whether the one or the other of these periods is of too long duration is a question to which various answers will be given. Some persons are of opinion that 3 years in the one case and 7 in the other would be a more eligible term than that adopted in this Constitution. In Great Britain, we find the House of Commons elected for 7 years. The House of Lords is perpetual, and the King never dies. The Parliament of Ireland is octennial. In various other parts of the British dominions, the House of Representatives sit during the royal pleasure and have been continued 20 years. This, sir, is a term undoubtedly too long. In a single state, I think annual elections most proper. But then there ought to be more branches in the legislature than one. An annual legislature possessed of supreme power may be properly termed an annual despotism. And, like an individual, they are subject to caprice and act as party spirit or spleen dictates. Hence that instability to the laws, which is the bane of republican governments.
Right. So when you have your politicians that only have an annual or every year, what they've basically become is a perpetual campaigning creature. They're constantly out there selling themselves and showing what they've done, and they're trying to highlight, you know, their little feat of cutting a sandwich diagonally and the brilliance of doing so instead of, you know, straight across. Because if attacked by some crazed assailant, the corner or the tip of the diagonal cut could be used as a weapon. Whatever. How would they justify it? Anyway, obviously we ran out of time. He kind of created this long list, and then he started going through the first complaint, and then he goes through the rest of these. We're going to actually go through the rest of these as highlighted. But anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.